Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dominic Holder, an adjunct professor in strategy and entrepreneurship at London Business School. And we talk about his experience of organisations, teams and leadership during this stormy period, a storm he predicts will continue for quite some time. We talk about the gap between those that make strategy and those impacted by it, touching on Karl Marx's concept of alienation, as the separation between work and home has blurred those boundaries and expectations, and possibly how we connect our individual purpose with the wider organisational purpose, something that more of us want to see more clearly. Whilst we explore what we can learn from philosophers such as Martin Buber, Dominic also keeps it practical with examples from his many roles across the many different worlds he's in: academia, consultancy, boardrooms, and social leadership. He draws on his Buddhist and Eastern teachings to consider deeper questions about human flourishing and engagement. Dominic isn't above reviewing his own contribution as a white, well-educated male, and explores how his experience as a trustee on a charity board has focused on the quality of how they work together, tuning in, as he calls it, particularly when emotions are heightened, when faced with topics such as race inequity and inclusion. He shares with us practical advice on how to flush out commitment when there's a range of sensitive choices, and reflect on the importance of both transparency and broadening our perspective in complex conversations. We talk about the responsibility of the most senior person in the room to share status, and the reciprocal challenge for us and the team to step in or step up and take our share of responsibility in how we are in the team. We explore the impact of heroic or hierarchical and flat leadership structures, and how what's needed at the team level varies and needs to differ based on the sector, the purpose and the nature of the work. Using his expertise in strategy, Dominic talks about the different purposes of teams with distinct phases, whether it's exploring or decision-making, execution or commitment or review, and the need for leadership and facilitation that adapts for those conversations. I'm not sure the metaphor for this conversation, and I'll let you judge that for yourself, but it felt a combination of weaving, wandering and responding to each other as we explored some of the big questions facing organisations, teams and leaders today. As Dominic reflected, there are times in history when we need to look beyond that which we know to include as many voices of difference, to be able to make sense of the complexity. But this isn't the space for academics alone. We need all organisations, government and society to contribute to broaden our perspectives and respond to this storm. Dominic is certainly one of life's big thinkers, who's in many worlds and importantly helps us integrate across those at many worlds using philosophy, learning and reflection, which does help in making sense of this complex world, this complex time. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. And perhaps as you listen to the episode, you can ask yourself, how does your organisation's purpose engage or interact with those within your organisation? And where's the biggest gap that might need attention? How expansive or diverse is your circle of go-to people? And how do you refresh to broaden your perspective? And finally, if you tuned in to your team, what would you see, hear, feel or notice? And how does this serve you and your team? Or ready you for the future? Hi, Dominic, and welcome to Team Timetable Talks. It's such a pleasure to have you join me today. And I'm fascinated by the space that you work in and what that means for leaders and teams. I wonder if you could introduce yourself and the work that you do for the benefit of our listeners.
I'd love to do that, Debbie. So as you know, my home base is London Business School, where I'm an adjunct professor in strategy and entrepreneurship, which of course covers a huge array of possible topics. But what I've been focusing on more and more is the link between the strategy for an organization and strategy in both a broader and narrower context, because I don't believe we can meaningfully consider a strategy for an organization without considering, if you like, the strategy for the world around it. So it can't just be a story in which the outcome is maximizing total returns to shareholders. We've also got to consider our much broader strategic impact in the world out there, particularly now as we are hopefully emerging from this crisis and moving into a very different world. But I also say narrower because people at the top of organizations and consultants, and I've been one, as a strategy consultant with Boston Consulting Group, we tend to be very interested in questions of strategy. Whereas people on the receiving end of strategy, when they hear that there's an exciting new one, immediately think about the additional sacrifice of discretionary time they're going to be asked to make. Long evenings, weekends, if we weren't doing enough of that already in this time of crisis. So one further question then is, how does my personal strategy map onto your business strategy? Mm. And this, of course, is going to be in the context of a team, because very, very few of us, are, other than academics, by the way, are in our rabbit holes just thinking wonderful thoughts on our own. We can't really be anyone without others. So from that standpoint, if you as a leader really want to bring the whole of me and my teammates with me, then your challenge is ensuring that there's emotional engagement with strategy through that kind of congruity between strategy for me personally, those around me, and where you're looking to take this enterprise. Mm. So those are the spaces I'm working in very much at the moment.
Well, and it does seem quite a topical space when we think about, you know, and one of my impressions through both my own work and speaking with other people is, you know, so whilst the pandemic has been similar, the experience during this period has had great diversity within it. And so I wonder, when you talk about the congruence between the individual strategy and the organizational strategy, what's your read on where we are in terms of, have we widened that? Have we narrowed that? What is it that you're sort of reflecting on in this last 12, 15 months in relation to the space that you work?
Great. So in one sense, the gap has opened up much more widely. And that's for an obvious reason, for those of us who've been working from home, because the beauty of the office was that we could cut ourselves off from children, spouse or partner, community, the beauty of the garden. We could just bring the shutters down on that personal life and we could be in the office life. And what we've seen during the pandemic, for better or worse, is that the shutters have not come down. So home has become the office for so many of us. If you're in a beautiful place like me in the Isle of Skye, then you're in a little paradise rather than having to flog across town to do lectures. I can do them from this wonderful place with infinite space around me. For others, like my assistant, it's been hell, stuck in a small flat with three roommates, sharing the broadband and the kitchen table. But either way, either way, the curtain that we brought down on home, as opposed to office, has disappeared. And I think that's going to be the case going forwards. But maybe even more importantly than that, Debbie, it's raised questions. Because when I went to the office, to the campus in my case, I would be stepping into a different kind of life. I'd be a different kind of person. And in fact, if I brought too much of it back home, I'd get into trouble because my partner would say to me, stop it, please, Dominic, you're not giving a lecture now. Mm. But with this collapsing, it does raise, you know, questions because it's me in both places. So I tend to have more questions around the key question, why? You know, why am I doing this? To what end? To what end? What really are the priorities? You know, before I could completely forget about the screaming children, leave them to someone else. You know, now I have to ask the question, how much time am I going to give to them? So I would say this is where, if you like, the challenge of congruity has got much wider. But there's also, to counterbalance that in many ways, a narrowing. Particularly because we're in crisis, there is the other why question, which is all around the impact that our organization is having for good on the world. And there is an opportunity for much closer congruity. Mm. So collapsing of home and office kind of asked me questions about, you know, why am I really doing this? And the impact of the crisis can, on a good day, provide me with some answers.
Mm. I think it is interesting just how much we even are hearing. So the individual's experience can have this great diversity and asking these big questions that really are questions for ourselves in terms of our meaning and how we make meaning. And the narrowing, though, is very far out there. And then there's...
Exactly.
There's the what's in between, and the in-between bits really are the team and the organisation, and of course you've got government and so forth, society. But it's how we kind of are connecting and the quality of that connection we as individuals are having. And for me, I think that's where, you know, the conversations that are quite live at the moment around future working habits and norms, and, you know, a lot of those conversations around place and time. But I wonder whether there's also an aspect to consider at the team level, which is really about that quality of connection and what we need to try and close that gap between the individual meaning and the world meaning, if you like.
That's right. And I can give an example there because the teams that I'm on personally are sometimes... temporary joining of forces with colleagues who I've known for years. And we're, in many cases, we're friends. So there's a very, very strong basis for trust, and we have a long history. So when I work with clients, the last thing I want to do is to employ people. So I want to work with really, you know, trusted peers who I know won't let me or the client down. And I can rely on that because we've done so much together. In fact, a number of these people are going to be those who I worked with in the past or people who I've got a lot of history with at London Business School. That's kind of easy. But of course, it does raise the question, how do you find new people like that?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, and this raises the question, if I can be a little bit pokey, of when we're sort of more faced with inclusion and diversity, if we typically, and what you say resonates in my world more in the consulting, people typically stick to their tried and tested, and you kind of say, well, there's benefits to that, but there's also risks to that. And how do we kind of, how do we expand that pool for the benefit, even if it means taking a risk? Because that's what we're expecting employees to do when we're talking about these changes.
That's right. And I guess, you know, sometimes there are those, you know, very productive moments of mini crisis where the person I've worked with for yonks sends me an email saying, I'm so sorry, I double booked. And then I think, what the heck am I going to do? And that's when I start to get a bit more creative. And I reach out. And indeed, you know, one personal advantage I have, and this may be helpful, is I do try to work in multiple worlds, or at least I do find I work in multiple worlds. So there's the world of business academia. There is the world of consulting. But then there's also my world of Buddhist practice. And there's also my world of social engagement through a couple of charity boards I'm on. And here in Scotland, there's plenty to engage with at a community level. And indeed, because it's going to be topical quite a while, at the political level as well. So I do find that for me, one way, lazy as I am, and my laziness has me go with the tried and tested. But one factor that does help is existing in multiple worlds, not just one. And that makes it, you know, easier to take the risk in the first place and also to somewhat mitigate the risk.
I mean, I think there is part of that sort of coming in from those different perspectives is kind of what what is really special about, for me, your work and your experience, because you kind of weave together important areas that aren't often woven together, if I may say. And you know, I know you're a co-author on the book What Philosophy Can Teach Us About Being a Better Leader. And I think it is that gift of being able to bring through those multiple worlds sight to questions or patterns or even relationships that we didn't notice. And I think it's hard for us to notice, you know, it's like the fish in the fishbowl. You don't know the quality of the water that you're in until somebody else sees it. And it brings news of difference, if you like.
Because habit can be very comforting. It's why we have habits.
Absolutely.
And in that book, by the way, and this might be, I think this could be, you know, a useful direction to go in. One philosopher who we speak about, who's been striking me more and more as I reflect during the pandemic, is Martin Buber. And Martin Buber spoke about relationships, and he contrasted the I-it relationship with the I-thou relationship. And the I-thou relationship is where we're fully engaged, and that engagement transforms the nature of the relationship. It also transforms ourselves. And there's something about being open to experience of the other, which is the key to that transformation. By contrast, I-it is where we're treating people in a very instrumental way. And of course, the catch is that we have to do that. And Martin Buber acknowledged it, which is to say, if we only approached people, and for that matter, trees, he has the most wonderful description in his book, I and Thou, on fully engaging and embracing a tree, which is one of the most wonderful images that, or metaphors that brings his idea to life. But if we were doing that all the time, we wouldn't be able to put food on the table. So instrumental relationships, I-it, are also important. But then, as ever, there's the question of balance and direction of travel. And one problem with the virtualization we've been through is that I-thou has got rather more difficult. Now, without wanting to tell tales out of school, there's a charity I've been involved in for many years as a trustee, which does fantastic work, mostly educational, as an INGO, an international NGO. And we make grants to NGOs, local NGOs, in extremely disadvantaged communities. So, for example, it might be a women's empowerment project, which is essentially educational, specifically focused on delaying the age of marriage, which can be transformational in many communities. So I say that to say we're doing really good work. But our board meetings, even though we've all known each other for a long time, have got increasingly fractious. Because the question, what about trust and the basis for trust, has emerged. And all the little conversations that you have where you kind of nod and wink, I know you shouldn't do that in meetings, but all of these kinds of things have a humanizing effect. Added to which, because we felt we needed to walk our own talk, because we do serve very diverse communities, we looked at ourselves and we saw that with hardly any exceptions, I'm afraid, like a lot of charities, the board was composed of somewhat older, still very well-meaning, white people with educated middle-class backgrounds. And as we have introduced the diversity agenda and indeed anti-racist training, some people were even wondering why we needed to do anti-racist training, because everything we did was about combating racial discrimination in the end. But you know, there's that whole theme of color blindness being something essentially unhelpful. But that really did start to put the cat among the pigeons and became extremely disruptive. And so the question, which I think is the question you were hinting at, is which way will that go? Will that go towards permanent disruption, or will we end up reconstituting ourselves and becoming a different kind of team with younger people from different backgrounds, maybe from the beneficiary communities we serve? We'd always been leery of that because we felt there'd be lobbying if we admitted beneficiary community people as trustees, or there'd be a big conflict of interests. So again, there'd been that, if you like, rather nice habitual team. We'd all known each other. We all shared a purpose, shared commitment, which we could rejoice in. And now we've upset the apple cart. And the crisis has done that too. So one of the important issues now is you know, how do we land this?
So let's come back to that, because I think that would be really useful to explore some of your thinking in relation to that. I mean, there's a couple of things that come to mind, and one of them is the, you know, when people try to think, well, how are we doing as a team? I think one of the easiest ways that you can kind of assess how you are is to look at the feel and structure for how you meet. Just something as simple as when we, you know, come together for our scheduled whatever, you know, what's the feel for that? How do we structure ourselves? How is it built around engagement versus transaction? What even, and this might sound odd, but what's your relationship to the agenda? How attached are you or not to what somebody, and usually it's a somebody, it's not often done across the team, to that? And I think that for me, that's just sort of a, as you were describing that, I could feel myself in those sort of meetings getting a bit more fractious. But the second thought was, I feel, you know, and I say this kind of at a community society level, that there has been higher levels of anxiety and emotion that we've seen and been exposed to in the workplace than ever before. Yet also at a time when we're trying to deal with some very complex issues, whether that's the response to the pandemic, whether that's the response to racial inequity in our society and many other topics. But we kind of need to be able to withstand and step into these more complex conversations, but at a time when we're emotionally, some of us emotionally a bit more fragile. So I'm kind of curious, as you look forward, what's your projection as to what is the work you and your team need to do?
So if we come back to structure, and structure isn't everything, but it's a foundation. So, you know, on a bad day, what we might do is to plunge straight into a busy agenda. And we've got 2.5 hours, and we've allowed 10 minutes for this, 5 minutes for that. Now, again, you know, if you've got people who come together, this is where people come together infrequently, because we're talking about a board as a team. And of course, we do need to get through the stuff, and some of it is statutory stuff, which we're obliged to get through. But then the question is, you know, do parts of ourselves get silenced in that process? And to some extent, they need to be, because if we just had a, you know, kind of free-for-all gusher, then we wouldn't be serving the interest of the beneficiaries of the organization particularly well. So what I feel we need to move to, particularly when we're not, you know, the group of same old colleagues that's been working together forever, is first of all to be much more reflective at the beginning and the end. So although I don't like the word, because it sort of sounds like electronics, tuning in is very important, And again, you know, in a board context, sometimes we have members of the management team present, which can then restrict what some board members might want to say as they tune in. So what we have started to do is to make sure we have time just for the board members. And the question really is, you know, how are we? What's on our minds? How are we feeling about the meeting ahead? That's been very helpful. And then, again, because this is a decision-making team, and we need to be clear, of course, there are different teams for different purposes, with different dynamics. This is a decision-making team. And we come back there, Debbie, to what you were saying about, you know, the extent to which people are emotionally attached to particular choices, for instance. So what we've started to do is something that we've already found very helpful, which is to explore boundaries around choices and commitment up front. So in other words, we have, before we get to any kind of decision, we flush out people's commitment to a particular choice. So in other words, the question might be, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, is this the kind of initiative which we would quit if it were followed, or quit if it were not followed?
And quit, you mean as a board member? It's
the, I've had enough of this. If you don't agree to this, I'm out. And then in between, you know, what's the range of initial feelings about the topic? Because that then, apart from anything else, is extremely valuable to whoever's leading the team, in this case, the chair. And it will indicate, you know, apart from anything else, how much time or, you know, how much emotional energy needs to go into the decision from that standpoint. And we found it very helpful. Something else that we've found, because on this particular board, we had just one person of color who everyone had known for ages, so much so we never thought of this person as a person of color. But as the anti-racist agenda and the backdrop in the last, you know, year or so became more vivid, actually, you know, just saying, oh, it's our, you know, it's old so-and-so, known each other for 30 years, that didn't really work anymore. And it then turned out that there had been a lot of, let's call it inadvertent harm. So what we've committed ourselves to doing is what we've been calling a restorative process with an independent restorative practitioner. And the purpose there is to you know, uncover those unresolved issues within the team and to identify whether in some cases those involved who might be polarized would like to have our facilitator act as a mediator, or where, you know, it might be when we, now that we're allowed to, going somewhere for a glass of wine to work it through. So I would say, and you know, back to one of my earlier books on mindfulness, it's about well, in my case, practicing what I preach and having a very marked degree of mindfulness for what's happening in the meeting. And again, because, as you say, it's a time of anxiety and a time in which the emotional stakes are much higher, we therefore have to be much more mindful of what might be bubbling up. And to be disciplined about that too. In other words, to create a structure rather than just saying, let's be mindful of what's bubbling up.
I mean, it sounds as, you know, as somebody who works with teams, that you've actually, you know, put in place some great noticings and awareness of, you know, so not just in the how do we feel about what's to come, but so how are we? You know, what's going on? And, you know, particularly to have seen and acknowledged that not only might there have been an inadvertent harm, but actually we're being active in stepping into that space, even if we don't know what that might bring. And I think there's two aspects of that for me that are really important. One is just the level of transparency that you are talking about, so trying to bring more to the fore. Here's actually how we are, how we operate, what the lived experience is. And the second is the invitation and perhaps requirement now, actually, and is, as you say it, to widen your perspective beyond your own experience, and genuinely to listen to another and acknowledge that not only might they have had a different experience, they have. We just didn't see it.
And to that point, in a different board context, after one of our Zoom meetings, one of my fellow board members asked to speak to me afterwards. And she said, you made a very good point in the board meeting, and it was great that everyone picked up on it. But she said, did you realize that I made the same point 20 minutes before and no one picked up on it then? And it would have been very nice if you could have recognized me and what I'd had to say and built on it. She said, I felt very excluded by them not really noticing me, and then you getting the spotlight, Dominic.
You just give me the chills. I've heard, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And actually, when we, you know, in some of my other work, when we run experiential exercises, the number of times we see it still play out live, you know, across any demographic, any age group, there's still that often female voice that isn't heard, and often male voice that is heard. And then there is this, so the unintended repercussions of that.
Maybe there's something in there. If for whatever reasons, good or bad, maybe mostly bad, certain people in the team have status, which means that they're listened to, then they do have an obligation to share that status.
Oh, I love that. And I mean, we don't often talk about it when we talk about teamwork, but a lot of the work is around power and psychological safety. And that, you know, so in that moment that you talked about, for that person, the chances are they didn't actually feel it safe enough to kind of, at the time in the group, say, hold on. did we just see what happened there? Not because it was about me, but because it speaks to the possibility of hearing the broadest of voices and noticing, actually, even with our colleagues, when something hasn't been said or something's been withheld. And often when we're talking about what this work at the team level is, this for me is the space. It's the noticing and then recognizing these things have ripples for, you know, not just that moment, but for often a long time afterwards. So I'm curious, if I may, what did you do with that piece of information? Did you, what happened next?
Well, we had a, you know, pretty full conversation about what had gone on. And I then had a little chat with our chair. I didn't mention this person, obviously, because I preserved confidentiality. And I said, you know, I said to our chair, you know, this happened. and it might be worth mentioning in the next board meeting how we need to conduct ourselves, or consider how we need to conduct ourselves, and particularly in this virtual environment, you know, how actively are we listening, and do we have all eyes on the chair, because the chair happens to be an important member of the great and the good, or are we, you know, also being mindful of each other?
Well, and because I
and the chair, and the chair, by the way, is, you know, a very reflective individual, even being one of the great and the good, and absolutely took that on board.
And I think we need to be careful that, you know, so when we say when one has status, there's an obligation to share it. Equally, there's an obligation on us not to keep kind of upholding the static nature of status by taking our share of that distribution of responsibility. And and so the very simple thing of actually, you know, can we agree that for today I'll speak when I notice something that's happening, and maybe we can just pause and say what's happening in right now, how are people, and and rotate that, say, so that we start to build the trust in what we notice, and that it's got validity to how we are, and therefore what's possible.
To give a slightly different example to that point, when I'm working with my students, what I like to do, and it'll depend a little bit on the nature of the course or the workshop, but what I like to do to avoid a parent-child relationship developing, in which I'm cross-mummy, as it were, what I like to do is to invite at the beginning of the course our students to collectively develop a learning contract. And then I would invite two students to volunteer to be the watchdogs who would observe the quality of the learning contract's execution. And at the beginning of the next session, which might be the next day, they report back what they observed. And there's then a discussion about what we can learn from that, what we can change. And then those two students nominate two other students to be their successors for the session ahead. And I found that that can do two things. So first of all, it's not as if I, the professor, am delegating to one academic representative who might then be, you know, the person who's stuck with the status and gets into a parent-child relationship that I've simply passed on. It means the responsibility starts to be genuinely shared, and I, you know, find the quality of interaction improves hugely when I do that. And we're, you know, we're not talking about kids here. We're talking about students who might well be in their 40s on our executive MBA or similar programs for experienced people. But it's amazing how quickly you can infantilize people if you are unmindful of, you know, structure and, you know, mode of engaging, particularly where status comes into the picture.
So just picking up on that, your experience has been actually to engage those participants in sharing the responsibility for that collective learning contract.
Correct.
So going back to what we talked about at the beginning in terms of the congruence or not between our individual need for meaning and the organizational need for meaning, I'm just curious what the link or relationship then is in how we engage with our staff in that sharing of responsibility, knowing how it engages, and as you say, it kind of allows us to shift to adult using that transactional analysis theory, rather than organization or leader as parent and we are all infantilized as children. So how can we bring that responsibility into the organizational world?
Well, here's a short story which might be relevant there. And again, it's sort of rather a story against myself or my own academic world.
Okay.
Because as you find in a lot of so-called professional environments, such as hospitals, law firms, and indeed universities, you tend to find a distinction a classic distinction between one bunch of people who are called faculty and another bunch of people who are called staff. Mm. And the purpose of the staff classically is to enable the faculty.
Yeah.
And so you tend to find it wouldn't be parent-child, it would be servant, mistress, or master would be the nature of the relationship. And you could sort of see how that made sense when the professor was kind of the total mistress of her craft and the experience, center stage, striding into the lecture theatre, occupying the podium, holding forth, and then, you know, there needed to be a number of things done to make that possible, like booking the room and making sure the room got cleaned, and that the whiteboards got cleaned between sessions, so the professor wouldn't, you know, have to get ink on her dress. So there were a whole lot of more or less invisible people called staff who were, you know, kind of working hard behind the scenes so that, like a great actor on stage, the professor could sweep in and strut his or her stuff. And you'd get that in a similar way traditionally in hospitals, where it would be the consultant, the surgeon, usually male, in the pinstripe suit with the carnation. And all the nursing staff, who'd typically be female, would stand to attention. And the consultant would make comment about the crisp corners of the sheets on the hospital bed, and then say, "Matron, let's go and see the next patient." And that was, I'm speaking in caricature, but this has been something that you find particularly in the professional world. Because for the professionals, there has to be so much investment in knowledge and so on, which makes them different creatures. However, one of the learnings, the important learnings from this crisis, is that reality is not like that. So the very fact that we're going, that we've been having to virtualize what we've done in education, means that, first of all, as the faculty person, you become much more acutely aware of who those people are who might support you. Because if the thing crashes, you can't do anything about it. You know, whereas in the old world, you could always, you know, busk, even if the computer system at the front of the podium wasn't working. You know, you could do something on the whiteboard to keep the thing going. But in the new world, you realize your total dependence on people who were previously unseen and often, frankly, you know, very underappreciated and unrecognized. What's more is, you need their knowledge. You need their knowledge because moving from an in-person session, which might have been incredibly animating and exciting, but you'd be striding around the room asking students questions. Well, you can't just clone that and shove it into a Zoom session. You have to really think about the design, the interaction, the way technology will be used, and so on. So I would say in our world, we've become teams as a result of the pandemic to a far greater extent than before. And to the question you were asking about the connection between the individual strategy and the organization strategy, well, let's say at the very least, the people who we would still regrettably call staff, well, they have a much clearer sense of the significance, the purpose, the importance of their jobs, and crucially, the connectedness of their jobs, which comes back to the questions of teams. Because if, you know, just the person who fixes the computer when it goes wrong, I have very little connection with anything else that happens. This, in fact, goes back to Karl Marx's definition of alienation way back, which is where what was a previously integrated life of work, everything gets broken down into different discrete tasks, and no one has much sense of how their work contributes to the finished product, and they have little communication with each other. That's Marx's definition of alienation, and you can see that in the contemporary world in spades. But what the crisis has done is to compel us to make those connections, at least in that academic context I work in. And I think there might be analogies in many other places.
I think one of the things that you make me think of is, you know, whether we're talking about the master servant or the parent child, is how our own sense of self and our own maturity, our own ego, can show up, you know, whatever our role is, in terms of how we need to be seen, how we need to be felt, how we need to be honoured. And I think, so I do think the pandemic has brought a light to that, but I think it's also made, and it's something I hope that will, you know, stay, but made us more able to see just how, when, if we're the one that are on a pedestal, that pedestal is not of our own making. If we've played an important part, and often there's luck involved, let's be honest, in terms of
how we got to where we got to.
And people don't often, you know, we want to honour and acknowledge, but equally we want to say, but I couldn't have done it without. And so I wonder, you know, I'd like to think that where we're shifting to does bring greater democracy, greater humanity. And yet I'm not so naive as to not recognise the power of the ego. And so I guess I'm curious as to where, as we sort of project forward, what are the forces that are going to be trying to bring us back to say, actually, that old structure really worked for me. I really like hierarchy because I fought my way up it. And yet there's something about the, you know, if we reflected on the levels of engagement, the levels of happiness, the levels of flourishing that we didn't quite have right in the old world. And I do think that, you know, whenever there are inflection points, it's an opportunity to shift to something new. But what would that new be as you move forward?
So this has struck me a lot, because in the business world, and, you know, in the political world and world of social activism, we do tend to have what I call a hero culture. So we tend to venerate those who've succeeded, which, by the way, can create quite a dangerous narcissistic feedback loop. And in the old myth of Narcissus wasn't on his own. He was always being followed by the nymph, who was called Echo. And she was chasing him all the time. She was deeply in love with Narcissus, and he completely ignored her. So all you could hear was Echo, 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 as she echoed Narcissus, desperately looking for approval, which, you know, might be withheld. So the combination of, you know, hero culture and a bias towards narcissism. One of our colleagues at INSEAD, Manfred Kett de Vries, who's a psychodynamic psychologist, has done a lot of work in borderline narcissistic personality disorder in leaders and how organizations actually select for those traits when they promote people. So I guess, you know, in the business school world, the sinful thing we do is to have these case studies which very much focus on one person who appears to be indeed a superhero. And what I like to do increasingly as an educator is to deconstruct that. So in one particular instance, I've got a case study of an organization which is written from the point of view of a superhero being responsible for its success. And then there's a companion case study of exactly the same events, which opens it up, and you start to be aware that there are other flesh and blood human beings. Be a little bit like, you know, you tend to find, and there was an interesting piece on alpha male behavior in Silicon Valley. People do tend to think they've succeeded because they're the greatest, and are then wildly overcompensated for those achievements. However, with a bit of humility, you might realize that so much of that is time and place and the other people who came before you. And if you happen to be leading a very successful organization right now, it's probably because other organizations failed and the learning got captured and probably great people moved from those less successful organizations to yours, which then happens to be on a roll. So I think that's one place where we can and need to do some deconstruction. The slight danger we have there is that there is a human tendency to hero worship. Mm. And it does tend to come out rather more in times of crisis. Mm. So, it's almost a kind of fascist thing. And indeed, a bit leery even of that word leader.
Mm. Well, I'm sort of also thinking with some organizations that I've worked with where not only is the individual rewarded for their individual, what seemed to be their individual achievement in something, there seems to be this sort of hidden drive nearly that these individuals can be put into these fires that weren't there before. And so it's mm-hmm. whether the firefighting sort of is actually present or it's the opportunity for people to come in and how much our own organizations are structured in terms of process to honor the hero and not acknowledge the team. And I'm thinking of particularly how we appraise and review performance and promote, etc. And there has been a shift from pure individual to include some team and some organizational, but not so much to include peer feedback. And I think as people get more senior, the peer relationships become more important mm-hmm. nearly than the hierarchical.
It'll depend to a degree, or at least the pace of change will depend to a degree on the nature of the sector. So let's say if you're running a quarry, crushing rock, crushing aggregates for someone to pick up and make a road with, you can sort of see how a hierarchical form might at least persist because you've got someone saying, you drive this machine for 2 hours, your task is to produce 200 tons of crushed rock, and your job is to tally the crushed rock, and so on. Now, again, quarrying remains a very important activity, so I don't think we should just dismiss some of these things as old world. But there's a little question around whether you would get the best out of the quarrying operation if you approached it entirely in that hierarchical command and control way. But conversely, if you look at knowledge-intensive organizations, by their very nature, hierarchy will screw them up. Mm. Because, again, in knowledge-intensive organizations, if I'm a skilled knowledge worker, what I really need is not instructions from some boss or boss's boss, but what I really need are really meaningful interactions with my peers. Mm. Because that's the way we advance. That's the way we advance. And again, without wanting to come back to the academic world, the job we all hate and which goes by rotation because it's hated so much is being the subject area chair. So you're the boss for 3 years, but actually the boss means you can't get on with your real work and you have to listen to endless complaints. Someone doesn't like their office, and then you have to go to all kinds of committee meetings. So typically it's the most junior full professor who's just been promoted who gets landed with the job of being the boss. Mm. And she will pass it on at the 3-year mark. If there's any other victim within range. So that's the kind of environment. And also, people behave in a boss-like manner. The employees in that particular case are just able to say, I won't do it. Mm. In fact, one of our former deans, some time ago, I hasten to add, said to me at one point, Dominic, I don't understand it. The only people who will do what I tell them to do are the people who aren't very good.
I think the academic world is certainly quite, it's got its peculiarities.
That's one of them. But it's not just the academic world. So in the consulting world, which we're, both from, I can remember, for example, at Boston Consulting Group, we evaluated, we had evaluations all the time. It got daunting, in fact. But the key evaluations were made by your peers on the project team because the manager, let alone the partner responsible for the project or the case, as we called it, would not have the best line of sight on where the contribution had come from. And then McKinsey have a very interesting system called the Practice Olympics, which is to do with assessing who's the best contributor of knowledge or contributors. That's not judged by the partners. It's entirely judged on a peer appraisal basis, and one which has teeth. So it's measured by whether or not your work gets cited by your peers in subsequent client-facing work. Mm. And again, I find something similar in the tech world. I did a lot of work with the German software SAP over the years, and they had this fantastic developer network of about 50,000 developers, and you could put a query into that and get it an answer back, a meaningful answer back within minutes. But again, what really counted was the likes or the meaningful appreciation those developers got from each other. And then you'll find, again, in the tech world, you can't even call it an organization. It's an ecosystem like Linux, where no one gets paid for working on that code, but it's done for the sake of peer recognition, which will then enhance your employability, obviously, in other contexts. So I'd say where we have knowledge that needs to be developed, created, developed, exchanged, applied, then hierarchy breaks down extremely quickly.
So. You're making me wonder where and what the role of team or teaming is in, and I know it's going to vary by what's the sector, what's the purpose of the team, but I wonder what are your reflections on the role of the team today and as you look forward?
Well, first of all, I would say there are teams and teams, teams with different purposes. And we could greatly expand the list of what those might be. And what's terribly important is being clear about that. And I'll just give one example from my area of client work, which is around execution of strategy. And in the old days, you used to have a bunch of people developing the strategy, and then people would be told what to do. And they might be working as teams with assigned roles in the execution of a task. Now, that was what I would call very much a linear approach to the execution of a strategy. These days, because things are so uncertain, you can't do that. So you have to have a much more iterative approach. You have to create more of a learning loop as you proceed into a very foggy or stormy future. And I do believe, by the way, that the storms are going to be with us for a very, very long time indeed, if not forever. And maybe the period of relative stability we went through is an outlier in historic terms. But what I tend to say is that you've got different execution teams. The members may overlap, but the beginning is being able to make sense of an ambiguous situation. And you need a team and a team leadership or facilitation, let's call it facilitation, that absolutely encourages open-mindedness, curiosity, where there's freedom to say anything, however stupid it might be. In fact, sometimes leaders who are very used to behaving in a red-blooded way should simply not be in the room in a meeting like that. But then there's something else, which is making choices. And that's where actually what you want is a hard-edged debate where people are not in exploratory mode but are taking up positions, and we'd land that by making some choices. And then there's another kind of team context. Again, all of this within the broad ambit of executing on a strategy, which is, you know, making it happen. And that's where the purpose of the team meeting is to establish commitment and track how we're doing against the commitment that we've set. It becomes very task-oriented at that point. And then closing the loop, I talk about being able to make revisions. So if it's gone unexpectedly well or unexpectedly badly, let's sift through the ashes or the unexpected results, which requires, again, very, very different team behavior and very, very different facilitation. And one of the challenges then is clarifying, you know, who needs to be in the room, what we need to be talking about, what we should not be doing in order to derail how the team works. But of course, then the other side of it is to make sure that there's sufficient transfer across those links rather than these being isolated activities. So that's saying to me that for in this context that I'm mentioning, which is quite a specific one, how we execute on a strategy, we need to have, first of all, great clarity about what actually the purpose of this team activity is and what it's not. We then need to have facilitation that matches that. And it may be that some of us are just, by dint of history, situation, personality, not suited to a particular team activity in that mix. But then again, you know, on a good day, some of us will be willing to change how we behave in a team context to match the nature of the task. And I mentioned that, I'd give an added spin on that, because in highly uncertain times, and we've been in highly uncertain times, and they're going to get less certain, bluntly. All of the you know, forecasts about what lies ahead are further apart than they've ever been. So we do need that kind of dynamism in our teams and the great clarity about what they're for.
It certainly resonates for me that. So I think you have to be clear what the team is there for, and the stage of what you're doing and whatever that thing is, strategy or other. And, you know, it certainly struck me. I remember being in strategy conversations, and particularly when it was the quarterly strategy updates for yeah. And it was always this sense that it was a thing.
Yeah.
Rather than a mentality. So it was kind of a noun rather than a verb. And I was, you know, one of my reflections was, you know, we need to broaden how we strategize rather than rest upon this thing that was written, you know, 2 months ago that we still think should be. And of course, the world's moved on, but it makes me, I certainly resonate with it's iterative. It's not a single process. But also we need to broaden during that exploring and that sort of review phase where we're hearing the feedback.
Way back in another very turbulent period, which was the 1970s, Shell introduced scenario planning, which they became famous for.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's sadly dead now. We had a wonderful colleague at London Business School, Aria de Herse, who'd been one of the creators of that approach, together with Pierre Wack, who used to apparently wear the robes of a Buddhist monk in his way into the Shell Centre in London. Now, a lot of people think scenario planning is about having a whole bunch of plans. And that's absolutely what it wasn't about. It was much more about how would you behave in this scenario? So it was much more an educational mission. But the other interesting thing was, you know, how those scenarios were constructed. And this sounds rather luxurious, describing it the way I'm about to. But Aria's team, Aria and Pierre's team, believed that the only way in which they could conjure up meaningful scenarios was not by talking to the leadership of Shell, of Royal Dutch Shell, or anyone in Shell. In fact, what they the mandate was to go and speak to interesting people, which might be in the arts, which might be in the world of politics, which might be interesting people you met on the street. Again, I think there came a point when things were less unstable and less uncertain as we moved into the 1980s, where someone at Shell said, why are we spending all this money talking to all of these weirdos? But in fact, Arias' point of view was that reaching out in that way was absolutely critical if you wanted to come up with something that hadn't already been thought of and worked through long ago, which you were just giving a few tweaks to. Now, again, you get a trade-off, don't you, between, having and a lot of these, when we're learning, there's a time for spreading our arms out and then a time for narrowing in and distilling and how do we make sense of all of that. So these two go together. But, the sense-making won't be sense-making if you started with just a very few signals and you've ignored the weak signals that might be around.
It's that sort of 2D model, isn't it? It's the divergent to converge to
exactly.
Then diverge again before you converge. And it just strikes me that when we're at a time when things are feeling so uncertain, certainly in some sectors and some, global outlooks, that the instinct, I think, can sometimes be to look inward and to pull tight when actually the way to assess whether your kind of path is a path that's likely to succeed is actually to kind of broaden. So I, where you say, it's maybe indulgent to think of this, I can't help but think it's essential that question.
This was the discussion within Shell, is it indulgent or not? And in highly uncertain times, no one believed it was indulgent. When things appeared to be stable and there was a gentle wind behind everyone's boat, then, why are we spending all our money on this? Why don't we kind of, the future's obvious, so let's narrow down. And I think in the business world, it's no surprise that the sort of the boom in private equity was during a very stable period of the noughties. And the whole idea of private equity is you cut out all the divergence, you make it everyone's task extremely simple, and the purpose is to sell the business in 3 or 4 years' time. And everyone gets rewarded for that, some a lot more than others. But that was very much, if you like, convergence, eliminating divergence. But right now, we're in a period where we absolutely need that. And you're right, in a time of crisis, there might be a period, actually, when we do need to really bolt everything down because the ship is in danger of sinking. And so the task isn't to think about the future. It's to make sure the cash flow is there and that we're collecting the money.
Is how we do both of those things.
Because if we get stuck in just pumping out the water, then the ship's never going to go anywhere, essentially. And how we do both, I think what I've also been saying is even, in the worst of the crisis, how do you keep the flame still burning? How do you keep the flame still burning? And this is where something quite harsh can arise, because it might be to keep that flame burning, to keep that divergent capacity still there, we need to accommodate more of what some people might regard as indulgent and luxurious. And it can seem unfair too, because, when we're cutting costs to the bone, here's this bunch of people who are still allowed to think thoughts. What's going on here? And in fact, one organization I was working with early on in the crisis, she was actually a very big NGO. The chief, not a UK one, the chief financial officer was saying, right, it's obvious what we're going to do. Every department is going to take 25% headcount. And then the CEO who I was working with, who is a young but very brave woman, said, that is absolutely not what we're going to do, because I'm afraid we're going to have to be unfair. We're going to have to discriminate, because actually if we cut everything by 25%, we'll be cutting our future, our ability to move into the future. And unfair as it may sound, there may have to be some areas which are cut a lot more than 25%, so that we can keep in place those who are going to enable our recovery. Very, very difficult, because of course, the way I've described it sounds rather abstract in percentages, but then it comes down to people and their lives. And that, I think, through the crisis, is one of the big challenges about that mix of divergent and convergent.
Well, and I, just to add another layer of complexity, I think we, and, as employees, have greater expectations than ever of what, what our life should be like, what our organization should be doing in the world. So, yes, there has to be a focus on, keeping this running. Yes, there has to be a focus on how do we build for the future. But we've also got to make it a future that better serves our human needs, whether as an individual, an employee, or whether a society. I think when I'm speaking with leaders, I can feel that, where do I even start?
Now, I think a lot of people are onto it, but have also discovered a workaround. Technology enables this, much more outsourcing. Much more outsourcing. So in other words, back to my earlier crisis analogy, well, the people who are your employees are the people who you really need for the diversity, for the divergent thinking, for the their ability to generate and exchange knowledge. And we treasure those. And then everything else, which is more of a quote unquote mechanical robotic nature, we outsource, so we don't have to bother about it. So if previously, when we employed everyone, a lot of things would seem unfair. Well, we've managed to slash through the unfairness knot in one go, because we treat those who we call our employees fairly, and then the rest are contractors, and they're independent business people, aren't they, Debbie? So they make their own choices and so on. And I would say, we've again seen a lot more of that through the pandemic. And indeed, I've seen organizations whose employees, who remain employees, are actually very, very engaged and happy and feel they're fairly treated, able to contribute in all kinds of ways. But then mysteriously the people down in the lower floors of the building have disappeared.
Well, and I think
that's, and I think I, we I know really you were have
alluding,
to watch that.
Yeah, I know you were alluding to it, but it's that veil of whether I've been fair or unfair, just because I've put a layer of distance between me and you by nature of how we contract. But actually, from the perspective of the individual, the contracting isn't the point. And so I go back to your one of, you talked earlier about, there's the faculty and then there's the staff. What shows up to our client, to the people in the room, isn't how we're employed. And that veil of fairness. So I what you're also making me think about is, We kind of think, but it gives you choice depending on how we relate to you. Again, let's not be naive. You and I probably have choices as to whether we accept something or not. Not everybody does. And let's not utilize that in a way that, again, supports that kind of nearly Machiavellian interest. Rather, and that's, I guess, what I want to flush out. And this sort of series is all about helping organizations become more human, more hopeful, more helpful, rather than hiding behind these veils.
So one of my favorite pictures in this context is one by Hieronymus Bosch, the hay wain. And at the top of the hay wain, you've got the prince and the princess. prince is playing on the lute for the princess, and there are angels around. And but then down at the bottom, you've got the mud and the knives and all the rest of it. And I think, you know, we are in danger of creating. Haywains have always been around, let's face it, but we're in danger of legitimizing them. Because again, back to fairness, we get outsourced. Well, you know, some of us might be, truly able to act as autonomous business people, making our choices, as you said, but others just have to, you know, deal with the cards that get dealt with them. And to say they're autonomous business people making choices is outrageous. Yeah. And so my fear is that we do, back broadly to the theme of teams, you know, end up with some really good teams of knowledge workers in a very positive environment, whether it's virtual or otherwise. And then we have the other, which has been pushed out beyond the boundary of the organization. And that we have to address. You know, if you look at confidence in capitalism, particularly among younger people, and this would be going back to the, you know, the last US election, there was something in The Economist beforehand showing that, more than 50% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 30 saw socialism, I guess, as defined by Bernie Sanders, as being way superior to capitalism as the kind of society they wanted to live in. I think the issue there is not primarily money going to shareholders or to CEOs. I think it's primarily down to the alienation that Marx was talking about, which back to teams you could characterize as complete disconnection.
Well, and that danger that we as leaders and organizations convince ourselves that we're the angels in your picture when actually we're the weapons. And it is just that, it's not an easy route. It's not easy choices, but we have to be kind of honest with ourselves in terms of what some of these choices mean in terms of consequences. It's been a fascinating conversation, Dominic, and I'm conscious we need to bring it to the close. As part of the ending, I've been asking my guests some consistent questions. And so I wonder if I could invite you to share with our listeners a micro practice that they could use with their teams in the spirit of being more human, more hopeful, more helpful.
So one thought there, because as I mentioned, I've been a Buddhist practitioner for many, many, many years, and mindfulness is very important to us, and so is kindness. And a practice which I've found very helpful, which kind of helps bring both to life, is a very old traditional Buddhist meditation practice, which in Sanskrit is called the Metta Bhavana, which translates as the development of kindness. And what the practice involves, and I would think any of us can take on, you know, a piece of this, because often when people consider meditation, they imagine sitting in an extremely painful position for a very long period of time, unable to move in case they get a disapproving look from the guru. This you can do. You can do it anywhere, any time, just sitting comfortably, which is to do with awareness, first of all, of, you know, just how we are. And that can begin by taking in how we are in a very physical sense. So what's it like to sit in this chair? What's it like to feel my feet on the floor? The chair under my sitting bones, the degree to which my back's supported or not. Then we can look a little bit more within and just reflect, not trying to change it, by the way, but just reflect on what our emotional state is now. And are we boiling hot, or are we rather, you know, distant and detached, or, you know, a bit dopey? Again, the idea is not to change anything, but then to drop into our awareness, a memory, to recollect someone who we're very close to, someone who we're very, very fond of. And if you imagine that person, and sometimes to imagine it helps to keep the eyes closed, as you bring that person to mind, what you feel, and again, you don't try and change anything, but just take in what those feelings are, and then to consider how your own feelings might have changed as a result of taking that person into your emotional awareness. And then what you can do, if you choose, is to extend that a bit further. And so it could be that you take in your fellow team members. How do you feel about them? If, by the way, there's someone who you anticipate will be particularly difficult as you let them into your mind, it might be quite a good idea to sort of leave them till last. Start with the easy is always a good principle in these contexts. And at the very least, what you'll be doing before your team meeting or your team engagement is to put more flesh and blood on the bones. Again, this could be particularly important if we're not going to see the experience of flesh and blood because we're in a virtual meeting. And it's the kind of practice which, you know, in its strict Buddhist context, ultimately you'd want to take out to the whole world. And in the sutta which accompanies meditation practice, the idea is that just as a mother will cherish her only child, in the same way you should learn to cherish all living things, which of course is a huge ambition, but we could at least start with our teams.
Mm. Thank you. Just a couple of final questions. What is it you are most hopeful for as you look ahead when we think of teams and leading?
Trust. Well, both hopeful and urging. When without wanting to get into a, you know, lecture or a rant, there's what, you know, there's a transactional kind of trust which is calculative. But I'd like us to be able to get to trust 2.0, which is where we trust that people really do care about what happens to me. And when I can, you know, honestly say that I do trust myself in when I say I really care about what happens to them. And that's trust that's gone beyond the calculative and the transactional. And we need that because in these very uncertain, stormy times, there'll be frequent occasions in which we're let down, in which the transaction breaks. So we need to rely on something stronger as a basis for trust.
Thank you. You take me back to one of your earlier things about Martin Buber's I-8, and the quality of trust in that environment compared with what I think you're describing is far more I-thou.
I-thou, yeah. Exactly.
And what can we do to be more helpful in our teams?
Listen is the obvious one. But when I say listen, listen at multiple levels. So yes, taking in what someone is saying, or even before that, taking in that there is someone speaking who we might not have noticed, back to my earlier example, and then taking in what they're actually saying. But then also listening at a deeper level yet, which is as they speak, where are they coming from emotionally? And even beyond that, you know, what's the meaning? Being inquisitive and curious about the meaning of what they're saying. So, again, in the laboratory conditions of a classroom, if my students ask a question, and this is not just me fobbing it off, I can say, so let's explore what lies behind that question. And that can reveal gold.
You're not the only guest who's mentioned listening. And I think that in itself is actually quite an interesting set of data, that if, you know, make the assumption that everyone I'm speaking to are practitioners and working actively with leaders and teams, and if one of the consistent threads is quality of listening, that that is consistently showing up as a, you know, it's such an easy thing to think of, but it's not an easy thing to stay when we're feeling less sure of ourselves. And it's that, you know, are we listening to understand or are we listening to reload?
Yeah. And am I preparing myself to make the next impactful statement?
Absolutely.
So
final ask, if I may, what inspires or galvanizes you?
I love life. And I want to taste it as much as I can while I still can. And I would like to open up that possibility for other people.
Wow. I had a moment there as you said that, because there's just sometimes when somebody says something that just hits you, and that was a moment for me. Thank you, Dominic. It's been such a pleasure weaving this path with you today and trying to explore a little bit more what we can do in our work with teams and with organizations to try and serve during this, you know, rather tumultuous period. So it's been a real joy to be able to speak to you.
I loved it, Debbie, and it was a great conversation with a lot of takeaways for me, and I hope for the listeners.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. I hope you find our conversation as interesting as I did. After years of practicing, I still learned so much from listening to the experience of others in this space. And Dominic brings such an interesting perspective, drawing on ancient philosophies, whether Buddhism or philosophers across so many ages, to try and make sense of our stormy time. I hope you enjoyed it too. And how did you get on with your questions? How does your organisation's purpose engage or interact with those in your organisation, particularly where there may be a gap that may need attention? How expansive or diverse is your circle of go-to people? And how are you at refreshing or broadening your perspective? And if you tuned in to your team, what would you notice? And how does this serve what you need now, as well as ready you for your future? My thanks to Dominic for joining me and sharing so generously. Each of these conversations helps us move forward, I think, in this quest to do better work, supporting teams becoming more human and more impactful. Details of how to get in touch with Dominic and any references that we've made are on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.